Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking.
Author of the Week on Literary Lusts, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous. This book has it all. It's a mystery, has recipes, an irrepressible heroine who is a cook. Set in England and Italy in the 18th century, the book is An Appetite for Violets by Martine Bailey and is published today, I believe. Yes. So, Martine, you're quite a serious cook yourself.
I have been known to enter a few cookery competitions in the past. I think I first became inspired by Spanish cookery on a Parador holiday and happened to see a competition for a recipe and entered something called the Merchant Gourmet Challenge. And it was actually quite a simple recipe, which I think is the trick for an Asturian stew. And I won that, which was very exciting.
Wow.
And won a from that, I won a course in Provence, learning French cookery. So that was really the beginning of my fascination.
How long ago was that?
That was about 7 years ago.
Wow. So it's literally the same time food has taken off as you know, yes. Your passion's grown.
Yes. So I think then I became very interested in French cookery and the history of French cookery, and that sort of laid the basis for parts of An Appetite for Violets.
It's true. Now, but you also won a prize, I just want to say, for something to do with sweets.
Yes.
Or puddings. What was that one?
That was a little bit later. I got hooked into these cookery competitions, and there was one for something called the UK Dessert Champion, which I think I could win for eating it. But I entered something.
What did you enter?
It was a summer fruit, cassis-soaked summer fruit and white chocolate cheesecake.
Oh.
Sent a lovely photograph as well, and it was chosen, and that led to creating that in the kitchen at Le Maurice in Paris. I didn't win that. It was very scary working in a professional kitchen. It was very hot.
Yeah.
But it was a fantastic experience, and I still kept, you know, the title.
And you invented that cheesecake?
Yes,
then.
I invented it. I tweaked it.
Are the berries within it or on the top?
Both. So you soak them in cassis, which, of course, I think anything with liqueur makes it, you know, really tasty. And then I think I just a little bit of arrowroot to thicken it and did a nice glaze as well.
God, it sounds so good. Just before lunch, I'm really hungry. So your heroine of Appetite for Violets, Biddy, is a cook, and each chapter starts with a recipe. What inspired you to write the book? What were the recipes from?
Right. Well, initially, the inspiration came from a visit to Erddig Hall near Chester, where there is a fabulous collection of 18th century recipes. And it just excited me. I just thought, these are marvellous. There were things like, you know, roast venison and almond pudding. And then I found out about even older recipes, which are held in household books that were given to women when they first got married. And they are more like scrapbooks with different handwriting from grandmas and cooks and neighbours. And that excited me, that these were, you know, collective experiences of food.
And they're real recipes.
Yes,
they're not something that someone's trying to impress anyone.
No.
They're what people really ate.
That's right. So
could you get to the archives, or how did you do it?
I found the archives for that particular Erddig Hall very locally to me in a local archive office. You know, they were very helpful at Harden office, and I handled a lot of the documents, and it was marvellous.
Wow.
Yes, yeah.
So you started handling them, looking at them, and at the same time you're thinking, I'll write a book? Or?
Oh, I think probably it's more instantaneous. I was in the kitchen and I thought, this is a wonderful, tranquil kitchen, beautiful big Venetian glass windows, perfect, very fine kitchen. But I thought, what would it be like if someone who worked in this serene environment, being a novelist, I thought, what would it be like if she was dragged off and taken somewhere else and exposed to lots of different amazing food in different countries? And from that, it grew into a much more sort of mysterious story as well.
Exactly, exactly. Now, I want to talk about the 18th century kitchen.
Yes.
What was it different than ours? Was it an open fire they cooked on?
Yes. So as part of the research, I did learn to cook Georgian food on an open fire with food historian Ivan Day. And that is, you know, so fierce compared to what we do where we, you know, I'll be honest, I'm, you know, put things in the microwave as well. But this is a long process of building a fire, of getting very hot. One of the things about my heroine is, her arms become quite scarred and burned because that is what happens. You're near spitting fat. But we did wonderful things with Ivan, everything from quince pies to cooking a real roast beef in Yorkshire with the fat going into the Yorkshire pudding and sweetbreads. Wow. And all sorts of things.
I was going to ask, how do you bake something on an open fire then? Right.
Then you also have ovens, which you might put kindling underneath or inside, like as when you cook baked bread. You put faggots
like
in.
Or like a pizza oven.
That's it. Yeah. So you'd put faggots in and then maybe remove them when it's hot enough.
What's faggots?
Just bundles of wood.
Yeah.
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 And so, you know, there would also often be, you will see an open fire and a baking oven. But that would only really be for the upper classes. And most people would either share an oven or mostly they would boil things. So puddings were boiled, and we did things like boiling puddings in cloths, which is ridiculously hard work. You know, you flour and butter an old piece of muslin and put your pudding in it. And that's why we have this idea of puddings as round things.
Yes.
But it's quite tricky, but they did that every day. Yes, virtually, they'd throw that in with the meat as it was boiling. Because most people had at least a cauldron pot and a fire.
Okay, so would it be like a suet pudding thing? And what would be inside it?
Just flour and fat and maybe currants, bit of sugar if they had it.
So that's where all our puddings come from.
That's right.
Exactly. Yeah. God, it's so interesting because it completely makes you understand.
British cookery, really. Yeah. Yeah.
So interesting. So you thought, well, I'm going to write this book and I'm going to write it as Biddy, the heroine.
Yes.
She's a cook from Cheshire, which helps because you're from there. And she writes it's like a diary. You call it a journal.
Yes, yes. So she is given, before she leaves, reluctantly leaves Cheshire, a household book, as I mentioned, a beautiful old book that she, you know, isn't hers. She's just given it. And in that she writes. So she writes not only the recipes for every chapter, because she is crazy about food. That's her big motivation. But also what's happening on this journey, and it becomes a chance for her to reflect on some of the strange things that are beginning to happen.
Because it all happens because she's working at a hall for Sir Geoffrey.
Yes.
And he marries a woman much younger than
himself.
The old story.
Yes, and she's a kind of, you know, certainly I wanted to make her quite a troubled teenager in a way, Lady Corinna. There are similar ages, her and Biddy, but very, very different in character. She's had quite a sort of different childhood.
And well, she seems very spoiled.
She's very spoiled. She loves clothes. But, I mean, you know, in character, she's no different from a lot of young women you might meet today.
Yeah.
She loves her lap dog. She loves sweet things.
Yeah, she eats really unhealthily.
She eats very unhealthily. And she wears makeup and she wants to go to Paris. So, you know, it's, to some extent, the book springs from the relationship between the two of them.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. So I loved her Cheshire accent. So you've got a slight one.
Yes.
How did you find out about, did you kind of find out about 18th century?
Partly. I mean, that's a mixture of, I'm originally from Lancashire.
Okay.
So in fact, Biddy really has a Lancashire accent because I started writing her speaking quite well and it didn't work. And I had to, I think very often you have to go back to what your memories, and I was born in Bury in Lancashire. And I remembered my granddad saying a bit of, you know, the old these and that's and all
I remember
this.
That in Yorkshire.
In Yorkshire, exactly. So I had to tune into that when I was writing her.
What, and did it come back to you, your mum?
Yes. And but I found a wonderful old resource by someone called Tim Bobbin, which was old dialect. And although if I'd written it all like that, it would have been incomprehensible. But there were just great words in there. And then I also felt that Biddy would have spoken a sort of culinary mix of, you know, she thinks food, so there was a lot of fun in the language and bits of slang, but I hope, you know, it's comprehensible.
No, it totally is. I mean, the thing about it is because it's a mystery and it's got everything, as I said at the beginning, it's got all the different threads, you know, that keep you page turning. Now, because she's a servant, you meet the other servants as well. And I just want to talk about, there's a black one, which was very fashionable in Georgian times. He turns up with Lady Corinna.
Yes, he does. Mm-hmm. In fact, the slight difference, though, to, you know, you do often see a black servant in, for instance, paintings and prints of that era. But he is rather unique in that he's from a place called Indonesia. Because, again, it seemed easier for me because my mother's roots were from Indonesia.
You don't look Indonesian.
No, I know. When, I have to add, it was the Dutch East Indies.
Oh.
So my mum was Dutch. It was a big colonial place at the time when she was born. Although there was some intermarriage, so that's
when
also
native. As
yes, yeah. So her family went over again quite relevantly in about 1750 as members of the Dutch East India Company. And I had recently spent time doing a gap year book, looking partly at my family history over there, and met some marvellous Indonesian people, particularly on an island called Flores, which few people have been to, but it's where, for instance, the Komodo dragons live. And lots of tribes, and there is a tribe of sea hunters who go out. They're one of the few tribes allowed to hunt whales and other big marine animals because that's their subsistence. They are
culturally done forever. Yeah. There aren't many of them, and they're not going to kill that many.
No, exactly. Mm. So, and I think one of the things that always fascinates me about Indonesia is they have this animist culture where there are spirits in boats, there are spirits in a knife, a spear, and they live in a world that is, you know, where the spirits of and the ancestors of the dead are very, very close to them. So I found that contrast with the 18th century world of Britain, where it's becoming increasingly consumerist, people love shopping, people are quite aspirational. And then to have a character who's completely on another level of time, you know, spirituality to some extent, but a loving, kind person who Biddy recognises isn't.
So they become friends.
Good friends. Yeah.
Radio Gorgeous, created by women for women. RadioGorgeous.com. So as you said, Biddy has to go off on her travels, has to leave the kitchen, get out of her comfort zone, and they travel all the way to Italy. Why did you choose Italy? Because you love French food, you said.
Yes, but when I read up about the 18th century, the real holy grail of travelling on the Grand Tour was Italy. And so that became very fascinating. There's a great deal of literature about that. And I also do love Italian food. It is fantastic. So I did, in fact, go to Italy a couple of times purely for research and had a particularly fantastic time following the route of a Grand Tour guidebook written by a Mr. Nugent in the 1760s, which is all about post houses and what you could buy and, you know, where you would get fresh horses because, you know, you had to change your horses every so many miles because you were pulling a heavy carriage full of stuff. Mm-hmm. So that was great. But I did stay in a place near Montepulciano, which became Ombrosa in the book. So it's very much that landscape of the hill towns, the lovely old stone villages, which are very beautiful, but when you're in them can also be slightly sinister as well and closed off.
You know, like dark furniture and dark, you know, dark kind of, because they're not mad on windows like
no,
us. They don't want
and,
heat.
And there are, you know, dark alleys and, you know, old ruins. And this, of course, is just as appealing to us as it was to the Georgians. And so is the food, you know, around Montepulciano, Pienza. It's pretty amazing. So it wasn't too much suffering to go there.
But when she goes to live in Italy, she hates the kitchen there, doesn't she?
Yes, yes. They turn up at a sort of very semi-derelict villa that, and she wonders, why are we here? Yet again, why on earth would we come to the middle of nowhere? And it's, you know, full of cockroaches and things, and she's really quite disgusted with it. But again, becomes interested in, you know, Italian food, starts going to the market and thinking it's not too bad. But there are a lot of other things going on by then.
There are.
So she's...
she's very busy at that
she's
point.
She's very busy.
Doing all sorts of things.
Yes.
As you'll find out.
Yes.
So I don't want to give the plot away, but the title is A Sweetie.
Yes.
Which Lady Karina absolutely loves.
Yes.
So can you tell us what it is and what the recipe is, please?
Right. This is a reference to violet pastilles, which is, as you said, our Lady Karina's favourite sweetmeats, as they were called then. And it's a very troublesome recipe for Biddy because she's a country cook. And Karina turns up with the archetypal gorgeous box with ribbons and pastilles in from confectioners were just beginning to set up in London, places like the Pot and Pineapple in London. Italians generally, again, were at the forefront of confectionery. And Biddy attempts to make them, not very easily, because it involves knowing about boiling points of sugar. It involves... we would add something like gelatine, which they didn't have. So, you know, gum tragacanth, I think it's, you know, it's all quite complicated. But basically, to make something like that would involve essence of violets and not buying it in those days, but, you know, real violets. Mm. And then, you know, boiling it to the correct temperature, putting it in wooden moulds. And it's, and she actually does have trouble with that.
She does.
Yeah.
So have you tried to make them?
I have not tried to make them because the equipment you would need even today, I think, you know, involving boiling equipment and moulds, I don't have. But I have made a number of things from the book.
I was going to say, yes. Well, where's the book? Where is it?
Behind you.
There it is. I was going to say, can you... tell us your favourite recipe and what you, or tell us what you've made in there. Now, what I'm shocked about recipes are that they're so big, you know, is that because it was for big households, you know?
I think...
large quantities.
Yes, yeah. I think people didn't fiddle around for a couple of people and they a lot of them are for big numbers of people in country houses where, you know, you might be cooking for 50 or at least a dozen. But of these, I suppose the one I made last night was soul cakes, which is a Cheshire speciality that's now disappeared largely.
So had you ever heard of them when you read about them?
I had never heard of them, but now I'm aware that there is still a tradition in Cheshire of souling on All Hallows' Eve.
So is that Halloween?
That is what we now call Halloween. Yeah. But way, way back in pre-medieval times, people baked special loaves or bread on All Hallows' Eve for the souls of the dead. There's no doubt about that. There are references from the 14th century saying it was an ancient tradition then. So this carried on, and by the 18th century in Cheshire country houses, it involved the sort of fun and tricks of Halloween. Oh. So mummers would come dressed up, would sing and perform a play, and in return they would receive these special soul cakes, which are lovely, delicious. I should have brought you some.
Yeah, tell me what
they're typical festival fare in that they're biscuity cakes that have sugar, spices and dried fruit, because those are the things that people didn't normally taste. They tasted very, very bland, unsweet, boring food day after day.
Kind of like, it was like a kind of porridge slop.
Yes, they'd have porridge. I mean, they'd have maybe bread and cheese when they're lucky, a bit of bacon when they were lucky. So the thought of going to the big house and having something that had sugar in it and dried fruit, and it was also, of course, you know, very good for you to have something like that once in a while. So you make them in little rounds. They're round. You put a cross on them for the dead souls. For these, I did a little rose water icing just to...
pretty them up.
Yes. I mean, and they just, you know, they look quite plain.
Do they taste like rock cakes?
They're probably more like a Shrewsbury biscuit.
I don't know what a Shrewsbury biscuit is.
Yeah, or a squashed fly biscuit.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So quite crumbly. Yeah, yeah. But I have to say, you know, the recipes are nowhere near as specific as the ones we have now, where it says, you know, I don't know.
Ounces.
You kind of go for it. And it helps.
Quarter of a teaspoon. Yeah. There it'd be like, take some flour.
Yeah, take flour as you need it, bake till enough. So it helps if you know how to bake biscuits, which is a dangerous thing for the hips. But if you can bake biscuits, it helps because you know then how to put them in hot, pull them out and cool them quickly on grills of metal and things like that, because that's...
Can you find a recipe to read it out to us?
This is a brandy posset. So a brandy posset would be a warm drink that would be a kind of mobile central heating, because you'd be very cold as you moved around inns and when you were travelling. So this would really be to warm you up before you go to bed. So this is... Take a bowl by the fire and break in 9 eggs mingled with half a bottle of brandy, 1 whole cinnamon, 3 blades of mace. Now grate in nutmeg for half a minute and place near the fire, taking care not to curdle. Heat a quart of cream with a basin of sugar and watch with care till it almost boils and frizzles at the edges. Lift it and pour from a height into the wine and eggs. Let it sit still by the fire till it is settled, then strew upon it fine sugar. And that's how it was given at the Star in Nantwich, served in a posset pot of blue stuff, and was as good as was ever made. Biddy Lee, 1772. So that's really, you know, something that's gone now. So I did enjoy finding things that, you know, you're really not going to find and today. And that is obviously quite an aristocratic drink because there are spices in it. But it also reflects the incredible amounts of alcohol that people drank in those days. Again, partly to stay warm, I think, but partly because, you know, we were at the centre of this new empire. And, you know, when you look at what was being imported, all the rums and the West Indian drinks and toasting was one of the things that people spent a lot of the day doing, toasting each other and getting drunk, from what I can tell.
Sounds quite good, really. Yeah. Now, it intrigues me because it said on your biog that you live in Cheshire and New Zealand.
Oh, right. That's
muddling.
Yes, it is. When I actually got the deal, I was living in New Zealand.
Wow.
We were escaping the recession in 2011, and we decided to go. My son was living in New Zealand, and we decided to just go off and have a bit of a midlife adventure. And the way that we managed that was to house swap our way around New Zealand and Australia for nearly 2 years.
Wow.
So at the time when I got the deal, I was living on the very remote East Cape of New Zealand in a fabulous house swap overlooking the ocean. And so I said, I am at the moment living in both New Zealand and the UK.
So what does the house swapping work?
Yeah, it takes an awful lot of organisation, but I just used the databases, the companies online. Someone has to sit and do a lot of emailing back and forth, but there are always people who are on the lookout to come to Britain and want to, you know, don't want to spend money on hotels or want to do it long term. So our first swap was for a year. to this place called Fakatani on the East Cape. And that was an English couple who'd gone out there and wanted to come back and see their family for a year, a retired couple. And after that, we found lots of Australians want to come over to Britain. And
is your house particularly nice?
It's fine. It's not palatial, but it's close to Chester, which is a draw. So it's Chester, North Wales. But largely it's driven as much by family links. So people might have relatives in Liverpool and think, oh, well, it'd be nice to stay, you know, reasonably close, but we'd rather stay in Chester.
Yes, I can see the point.
But yes, it just takes a lot of organisation.
And it worked for
you. It worked.
Fantastic. Yes, yeah. And now you're back living in the UK. Yes. I just need to quickly ask before we finish, what are you writing now?
When I got this amazing deal in this basement of this house in New Zealand, my agent said, you've got to have a synopsis ready for the new one. And I'm writing something also set in the north of England, but with references to Australia and New Zealand. So it's got a cook in it because and I'm so thrilled because I had a fantastic compliment from Faye Weldon yesterday. She said, I've invented a new genre, the culinary gothic. So I'm really, you know, over the moon about this. And this book is also about a cook who has a hidden character as a escaped Botany Bay convict. So she's working for a naive young wife, and it's very much about the tension between that escalates and escalates because, you know, there is, again, a lot of hidden twists and turns in the plot.
Fantastic! So this is so exciting. An Appetite for Violets by Martine Bailey is published by Hedder & Stoughton, and thank you so much for coming on to Radio
Thank
Gorgeous.
You, Josephine. It's been fabulous.
And I'm so excited that you have now created a new genre called the Culinary Gothic.
Thank you. Thank you, Josephine. It's been fantastic.